Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Although this is actually the very first episode of my brand new podcast called Modern Finance. I'm excited to launch this show and tell you what it's about, but I think I need to take a step back and really unpack for you why I think it's so important that this show exists today and why you should subscribe. So I read a report that said for the very first time in Q4 of 2020, there have been more institutional money going in to purchase cryptocurrency than retail. So what does that mean? That means that VC firms, funds, family offices of billionaires, big corporations, ones like Square and Tesla, the two that have made announcements that they bought crypto, all of these big firms with hundreds of billions of dollars are now buying cryptocurrency at a rate that is outpacing consumers. So if this trend continues, and Apple gets into the game, Google gets into the game, every other major Fortune 1000, and even governments, if this happens, we're talking about trillions of dollars entering into the cryptocurrency space. This could be one of those crazy moments that a decade from now, we look back and we say, this is as big as the internet or the iPhone or, I don't know, like when Amazon launched. Like, this is just one of those crazy world-changing moments. And when I say world-changing, I mean a few different things. One, this idea of a universal currency that is accepted globally could be world-changing. Two, all of finance, traditional finance, it's being reimagined on the blockchain. So there's this whole movement right now called decentralized finance or DeFi, and there's hundreds of millions of dollars that are moving into these brand new financial instruments, these smart contracts. Now, the good news is I'm in the middle of all of this. As a partner over at True Ventures, we're looking at so many different crypto deals. I probably see, well, gosh, so far this year, I probably looked at least 30 deals with my partners. And we've already deployed, you know, millions of dollars into some really exciting new projects. But I have analysts and other partners to bounce ideas off of. But the average consumer just doesn't have the time to go this deep, because there's just so much going on. How do you stay up to speed? And then how do you even understand? A lot of this stuff is pretty technically complex. How do you break it down so that you can understand it? And that's why I wanted to create this show. I feel like it would be such a missed opportunity and a shame for the average consumer to not understand what's going on. And so for me, my goal is to make sure this information is broken down into something you can understand. It goes as far and as wide as possible so that all people have access to this information, because it really is changing the financial landscape, and now is the time to pay attention. So the new podcast, it's called Modern Finance, MoFi for short. It's going to cover all the new exciting projects and trends in this space, but you're going to have to subscribe to a brand new show. You can head on over to mofi.net, M-O-F-I.net. There'll be all the links there. It'll take a tap or two, and they'll be all signed up. And this is the first episode about these crazy new digital collectibles called NFTs that are bought, sold, and managed on the blockchain.
Kevin Rose and his guests are not registered investment advisors. All opinions are Kevin's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for investment decisions, nor is it investment advice. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Please work directly with an investment professional.
Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome to Modern Finance, aka MoFi. I am thrilled that you're here. This is a brand new show for me, and I'm pretty pumped because it is a combination of two very important worlds. One, the cryptocurrency world, what's going on there with DeFi, all of the craziness around NFTs, everything that is the chaos and excitement around these new digital-first assets, and then also traditional finance. So stocks, bonds, robo-investing, traditional finance tips and hacks. It's going to be a fantastic variety show that puts it all under one umbrella that I'm calling Modern Finance. So thanks for joining me. Now, this episode is all about NFTs. These are called non-fungible tokens. These are digital assets that can be art, they can be sports cards and videos, they could be music, and they're all traded and collected entirely on the blockchain. This is certainly the hottest topic right now, but if you have no idea what I'm talking about, it's not a big deal. We start with the very basics. All right, today's guest is Aftab, probably known best in the NFT world as DC Investor on Twitter. He was very early in NFT and breaks down the entire ecosystem for us. Let's chat with him. DC Investor, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Kevin. I'm really excited to discuss NFTs and other things blockchain with you.
Well, dude, you're absolutely a legend, at least on Twitter and in this universe. A lot of the stuff that I know I haven't told you this yet, but when I first started getting into the space and kind of starting to follow people that were into it, you were one of the first people that was recommended to follow. And I've always really enjoyed your thoughtfulness and your take on Twitter about some of these various projects. You seem to be insanely well-versed on everything that's going on in this space. And I would love to start off by breaking this down for people, because for so many people, I mean, I was very lucky that a friend of mine turned me on to CryptoPunks a few years ago, and I got started that way. But for so many people, they're like, what the hell is this NFT stuff? It's been all over the news. Can we start off by just defining what's going on in a very simple way?
Sure. And, you know, the term NFT is actually a really broad one. And I'll start off by talking about tokens a little bit. And I think a lot of your audience is probably familiar with the idea of blockchain technology, and in particular, blockchains, public blockchains like Bitcoin and Ethereum. Mm-hmm. And within, you know, and I'll actually define NFTs by exclusion from fungible tokens first. So a fungible token is really any token where, you know, two units of it are basically interchangeable. So Ethereum and Bitcoin are both examples of fungible tokens, insofar as if you send me one Ether as payment for something, I don't really care which Ether you send me. I don't care which wallet you send it to me from. I'll take either one. And once they're in my wallet, they basically become commingled and I can't really separate out which Ether was which, right? Just my balance is increased by one. This is in contrast to the idea of non-fungible tokens, where every NFT is really a unique asset and is tokenized on the blockchain. And right now, most of these assets are tokenized on the Ethereum blockchain because it has the programmability needed to support this. So you'll see NFTs created for a broad range of digital assets. And you see them now for collectibles, you're seeing them for artwork, you're seeing them for access rights tokens, you're also seeing them emerge for financial contracts. So the term NFT is actually really broad in that respect. But when you hear about it talked about in kind of the popular narrative, it's really focused on those collectibles and that artwork.
Right. Gotcha. And I think take it a step further and apply it to artwork. If you think about if we were texting back and forth, let's just say over iMessage or something, and I'm sending you an animated GIF, in that case, that's not tied to the blockchain. It's kind of just a copy of it, right? And we're holding the same asset. I sent you the same GIF that I have on my phone. You have it on your phone. You could send it to somebody else. And there's no distinction between that. So those are all fungible. Now, that changes when that asset is tied to a token. Can you go into actually how that happens and what that change is?
Sure. And I think I'll just say that I know for a lot of people, the concept of digital scarcity is still hard to grasp, especially for those of us who grew up with the consumer internet, because literally everything was copy-pastable.
Yes.
Right? You can download any image, and this was even before videos. There was a lot of illegal software that was being downloaded and traded with each other back in those early days of the internet. So the idea of digital scarcity as it has emerged in blockchain, I think is actually best represented in public blockchains like Bitcoin and Ethereum. Those are coins which have supplies that are known. And so you can't fake a Bitcoin and you can't fake an Ether. If I send you one of those assets, the blockchain basically verifies its provenance and says, okay, Kevin, Aftab has sent you one Ethereum or he sent you one Bitcoin. And that cannot be faked. Similarly, for NFTs, it's the same kind of idea. And when they get tokenized on the blockchain, there's basically what is called a smart contract, which creates that asset. And once it exists on that blockchain, and again, most of these are kind of on Ethereum, it can interoperate with apps that are on the platform. And because it's on Ethereum, which is a public ledger, that means anyone can go in and look at it at any time and verify, you know, if I tell you, Kevin, that I send you one CryptoPunk, I can't fake that. The blockchain mm-hmm. has provable, perfect provenance. There is no such thing as counterfeiting in that respect, because you can know with surety if I send it to you, okay, 100%, this is a real CryptoPunk. And I think that's one of the unique aspects of digital ownership that we're all going to have to kind of come to terms with. And I think the NFT revolution is actually going to be a great way to introduce that to a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like a great example of like the first point that anyone will always point out is they say, okay, well, can't you just take a picture of it? Can't you just take a picture and send it to someone else? And the answer is yes, you could take a picture of a CryptoPunk, which for those of you that don't know, they're these little pixelated characters that they're just like little punks with mohawks and all different kinds of things. They're silly little artwork, but we'll get into actually how they're not that silly in a little bit. But you could send I could take a screenshot of it and send it to you over text message. But then what you would do is say, well, wait a second, let me look on the blockchain and see if Kevin actually sent this, and you would see that I did not actually send it. It hasn't been recorded in the blockchain. It did not move. It wasn't recorded to go to your wallet. It was just a copy. So you could easily point out that it hadn't moved from my wallet to your wallet, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, a lot of people will say, well, what's the point, Kevin? Because if you can just create a copy of that image, then what is the value in it for you or for someone else who's collecting it? I think, you know, this comes down to something that is like a really human trait, and that is that people like to collect things. And there's a lot of reasons why people like to collect things and be able to say, hey, I own this. This isn't just a copy of it. I own it, right? And I think, like, for example, let's just take the Mona Lisa as an example, probably the world's most famous painting. There's only one real Mona Lisa that exists, right? It hangs in the Louvre, and it's behind several inches of glass, and you can go and see it. But there are copies of images of the Mona Lisa all over the internet. You can buy replicas of the Mona Lisa. Mm-hmm. You can buy posters. You can buy fake paintings of it.
Insanely high res too. Like you would, like if you put it up on a wall, you'd be like, wow, that looks like a real painting, right?
Absolutely. And if you just admire the aesthetics and that's all that matters to you, that might be fine. You know, if you want to buy a fake Mona Lisa and hang it up, go for it. There might be people who come in over to your house and say, why do you have a fake Mona Lisa on your wall? That's kind of weird, you know? And so, right. So there is that dynamic. And I have prints of artwork in my own home, and I put them up because I like it, you know, but I'm not pretending like they're the real thing. And I think with NFTs, you're going to see a lot of that too. People want to collect them because they are scarce. And I think that's one element of it for sure. In addition, I think for a lot of people, they just remind people of a lot of people view these as pieces of emerging history, right? And so they want to buy them now, and they want to be able to hold on to them and look back on it and say, hey, this reminds me of that time. Maybe they pass it on to their kids. Maybe they sell it at some point. So that's one reason why people buy these things. Another reason is, you know, as old as mankind, is kind of bragging rights or a status symbol, right? Sometimes people want to have that and be able to point to, hey, I own one of these, and this is the only one in the world, right? And I'm the only one who can claim ownership over this,
right?
And that's interesting for some people. I think also for some NFTs, you're going to see that they have actual utility increasingly. And so you're going to see more in-game items, which are going to be tokenized on public blockchains, and they're going to be usable in a game and provide specific functionality. And then the final point that I think why people collect things is a lot of people actually use collectibles as stores of value. And I know people are going to think that's crazy that I say that. And I'm not necessarily talking about Beanie Babies, right? I mean, maybe there are some people who store value in Beanie Babies, but I'm talking about specifically like the high-end art market. Mm-hmm. And some of the valuations on those paintings go for insane amounts. And you would actually be surprised that a lot of those paintings and the owners who own them never actually take custody of the paintings. They are sitting in what are called free ports in places like Switzerland, and they sit in a warehouse protected, and the ownership just transfers between, you know, one holder to another. And this is how a lot of wealthy people use art as a store of value. So I think NFTs are going to become popular for similar kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because in that case, they look at it as a kind of a diversified an asset class that is different than the stuff they're typically investing in, but one that they want to have. And so that's why they don't actually put it on their walls, but they keep it in these vaults. The nice thing about NFTs is you don't have to do that. They can just move around freely digitally and you have them. And it also makes sense in that if you think about what we've done traditionally, anytime art was created and manifested in the real world, it was very easy to say, I can hand this off to someone, but with digital first and digital native tools, how would you ever say something is an original? And this allows us to say, this was the original. The artist has deemed this as the original, and there's only this many copies. And I think the copies is a really interesting piece, especially when it comes to collectibles. One of the things that I've been tracking, as silly as it sounds, is I was into comics when I was much younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought Wolverine number one, the very first Wolverine, not the, his first appearance, but when he had his own comic. And this was in the 1980s. And you can buy a Wolverine number one on eBay right now that has been graded by a professional grading house for about $150. And that is insanely cheap given how old that is. And I was wondering, what is going on here? Why is this like amazing cover, great comics, so inexpensive given how in the Marvel universe it is such a primary character, right? And I did some research. I talked to some collectors and someone came out and said, you know, Marvel never published their official figures as to how many of these they printed. The estimate is over 300,000. And I was like, oh my God, that's why they're at $150 and not $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, right?
Right.
Because there's just so many of these and there's no legal issue here. They can print as many as they want. They just knew heading into this comic, it was going to be a popular one. So they printed a shit ton of them, right? So the nice thing about NFTs is you can look on the blockchain and say, no, actually there were only 50 of this digital sports card or this comic book or this piece of art. And you can prove that on chain that is cemented in there forever. Which is there is some value there.
Absolutely. And I think you've hit on some of the reasons why I think digital collectibles are actually going to become more desirable than physical collectibles in some cases. And already we see them fetching higher prices in some cases. And I think the perfect provenance is probably the most important attribute. So when you buy it, you know exactly how many copies of that NFT exist. It could be one or it could be any number, but you know how many copies exist. You know which copy you own and you can see who owns the others. And there can be no counterfeits. And counterfeiting is a real issue when it comes to high value physical collectibles. I mean, and some of your listeners may be familiar with the card game Magic the Gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And there are cards like the Black Lotus, which is actually the most rare and most valuable Magic the Gathering card printed in its alpha printing. I think the values of that go for certainly in the hundreds of thousands in some cases for graded copies.
Right.
But if you go on eBay right now, I guarantee you that you can find several fake Black Lotus listings. And
yeah,
if you're buying one, especially that is not graded, that's very high risk. So I think that that's a huge benefit of NFTs. Another thing to think about is these really can't be damaged. And while they could be stolen if your private key is compromised or if someone, you know, is able to steal that, it's a lot more secure. You don't have to worry about a fire necessarily destroying your assets.
Right.
And no one can steal it from you in kind of most circumstances. And I think there's also all of these other interesting properties and utility that will come from digital collectibles and NFTs in particular. And those come down to the ability to like fractionalize ownership. So if you can't afford a whole Black Lotus or, you know, let's say there's a digital Black Lotus, if such a thing existed, right? Or one, a whole like Beeple NFT or a whole CryptoPunk, you can fractionalize that and you can sell pieces of it and you can still have price exposure to that. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, we're also seeing that NFTs are going to be usable in this decentralized financial stack that is emerging on Ethereum. And some of your listeners may have heard of this concept known as DeFi, but basically these are disintermediated financial services being provided on blockchains like Ethereum without any counterparty, without any intermediaries. And they're designed for natively digital assets. And I think we're going to see more use of NFTs in those.
Yeah, I agree. I'm curious, let's go back to the very first NFT project. Would you agree that CryptoPunks, everyone points to that as being like the first to actually encode, you know, I guess they did a hash of what the punk looked like into the blockchain. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, in general, I think most people recognize CryptoPunks as the first non-fungible token, certainly on Ethereum. There's some dispute on whether a project called CryptoPepes was first and if those were NFTs. I can't really go into a lot of detail on that personally, but most collectors recognize CryptoPunks as the first non-fungible token.
And so CryptoPunks, really cool project, little 25 by 25 icons. There's zombies, there's apes, there's aliens, there's punk rockers with mohawks, there's 3D glasses, there's VR headsets, there's all these different attributes. And I believe there were, 10,000 of them in total? Is that right?
Yep. There were 10,000 at launch, and they were basically given away, which I think is a really interesting piece to the story. They were basically given away. And for a long time after they launched, I think they didn't even end up 100% claimed for a while. And I wasn't really paying a lot of attention to the space at that point. I think I heard about them once. I know some friends who grabbed a bunch of them and they've done pretty well. The ones that just held onto them and forgot about them have done really well. But they were basically given away. And I think that's an interesting piece of the origin story there.
Yeah. I mean, so gosh, what happened for me is I had a buddy reach out to me, my friend Patrick, who is a childhood friend and is oddly enough, many years we didn't chat for 30 years or whatever, and then got back together. We were both into crypto, which is weird. But he was like, "Hey, you need to get on these punks, and they're being released." And so I picked up 10 of them,
nice,
and just kept them in a wallet and forgot about them. I actually lost the wallet, and it was in a wallet called Parity at the time, which was not MetaMask, and it was hard for me to get them back out. I eventually figured out where they were. I got them back out, and the price had gone up from next to nothing to hundreds of thousands of dollars for this collection of 10, which is just insane. And I believe that, a lot of the people that I know that are collecting them now, Gary Vaynerchuk's the world who I chatted with about this, he's buying up a bunch of them. I have a few other friends that are collecting them. And as silly as they seem when you look at them and you're like, this is really silly, why is anyone buying them? There's a couple of check boxes I think that they check. One, the original, if they are considered to be the original first project cemented in the blockchain, there is some value there in being the first, right? So people are looking at this and saying, this is historic. This is why they have value. The second thing is they actually, once you start to get into the attributes and how certain ones are more rare than others, there's something very kind of like fun and culty about going down that path of just like, which attributes are more rare than others. And I like the way that this guy looks. And I think the silly red nose looks cool. And they're also so dorky and pixelated. They actually make great wall art. Like I wouldn't mind having a digital frame, and they're very recognizable in that way. Are you a fan? Are you a collector?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of why they're desirable, and they kind of have this 8-bit, maybe 16-bit, but they've kind of got that kind of charm to them. And the fact that they were given away for free and basically, they were almost never intended to have value really, or at least the creators never really spoke about them in that way. But they became this thing that became insanely valuable. So I am a collector of punks. I don't have a huge collection myself, and I probably sat on the sidelines for too long. But really, over the past few months, as I started to see this NFT fever start to take hold, I kind of started to get into it. And so I have several punks now that I own. I can't claim ownership of any really rare ones, but I just think they're really cool. I have one set as my avatar for Twitter and most of my online personalities, one with a hoodie, which is a somewhat kind of more rare characteristic. And I just think they're fun, and they kind of embody the whole spirit of what NFTs are about to me, that digital scarcity, the fun aspect of the art and collectible, and that provenance and that interesting origin story. So for me, they really kind of represent one of the most perfect crypto collectibles.
Yeah, I agree. And with my 10, when I got them out, the first thing I did was I picked up, I realized that these were kind of going up because I'd seen the prices start to climb. And then it just dawned on me that this is just like cryptocurrency in many ways. Like anyone that's been in the cryptocurrency for a long time, we've been through these crazy bubbles pop back down, but the floor is always higher than the last floor. And that always just, that's that kind of like natural step function, which is always occur over time. And it's when I think about NFTs and digital collectibles, in my mind, I'm like, well, it's just a matter of time before people consider this to be art. And the meaning, not just the us nerds that are into it right now and using MetaMask and doing all these weird fancy signing to get these assets, but the general kind of mainstream public. And I think NBA Top Shots has done that, and that the onboarding is much easier. And it's just going to be a whole slew of other projects over the coming months and years that I believe that these will just be, you know, we already saw it, right? Christie's auctioned off an NFT, a traditional auction house, like the Christie's and the Sotheby's and the Phillips and like these big, massive old school auction houses that do, you know, Picasso's and like all these Rembrandts and all these crazy paintings. They're actually doing digital now. They're putting their toe in the water and trying out auctioning off digital NFTs, which is huge. The fact that they would even acknowledge it is a big step in that direction. And so I want to own a piece of that history. And so what I did is I couldn't talk my wife into, well, she would probably would have been okay with it, but like, you know, holding a shit ton of money in NFTs is a little crazy. So yeah. I sold my original 10 and I bought one zombie. So I said, okay, I'm going to go with less CryptoPunks, but one that is insanely more rare. And so there's only 88 zombies. And so I got one of the zombies, and I got one with a smile on his face, because I don't know, I like the, he looks a little more honest to me than some of the other zombies that look like they're kind of pissed off. So yeah, it's fun.
Nice.
It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw your zombie, and it's a great one. And I think, you know, what's interesting about it, and there's a lot of kind of theories from looking at non-digital collectibles that I think are going to start to apply more to digital collectibles and digital art. And so we're starting to see that now. So your move to move up to a zombie may have actually been a smart one. And I think all CryptoPunks will probably establish some kind of floor value, but zombies are certainly more rare. And it's possible that those move up in value faster and retain it better, because they're more desirable and more exclusive. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics like that that we're, and the cool thing about this, by the way, is that you can observe all these dynamics in real time on the public blockchain on Ethereum.
Yes.
Right. And so I think, like, I don't know if there are many economists observing this space right now, but I certainly hope there are, because there's so many little economic experiments being run on Ethereum right now, which I feel like economic researchers could have a field day with. And I think we are seeing that with collectibles now. I will say, and you kind of mentioned the bubbly aspect of this, and I do think it's important to reinforce this for your listeners. You know, everything in crypto tends to get ahead of itself at times.
Yes, 100%.
It's really hard for me to say if we're ahead of things right now or if the market is just catching up to what the true valuation of these are. So I certainly won't say, well, this is certainly the top. But I do think if you enter into any NFTs, I always say the best thing to do is to buy things you truly love and you want to collect. If you're buying to flip, if you think I'm going to buy this because I'm going to sell it for more in a year from now, you could end up really out of luck. And so just be careful and don't put money into this stuff you can't afford to lose.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That is such great advice. And it's certainly something that, you know, when I got that zombie, I was like, well, I don't really care if this gets chopped in half or in three quarters valuation wise, because I want to hold this for the next 20 years. You know, like this is something like I just believe in the authenticity around the very first of something. And this is the first of the NFTs in the blockchain. And I love the character. He's a cool little piece of art I want on my wall. So I'm just going to forget about it and hold it. And I think that's exactly right. Like, who knows where the prices can go? It's going to be, there's no doubt if it's anything like cryptocurrency, which it is, it's going to be a roller coaster and there's going to be a few loop-de-loops in the middle of it. So it's going to be crazy. But so what other projects, I'm curious, when you look at this stuff that's out there, because there's just so many coming online. And I think one of the things that is that's really scary to me, well, it's good in that the onboarding of artists coming on to be able to produce NFTs, those tools are more readily available and they're getting easier for artists to come on. So if you're an artist today, you're good in Photoshop, like you can pretty easily go and mint your own NFT and try and sell it, which is cool. But that said, it means everyone with Photoshop is instantly an artist, right? So how do you sift through all the stuff that's out there?
So mentally, I look at the market and I break it up mostly into like three primary segments. And the first is kind of what I'll say are more of these celebrity and brand oriented offerings. And we're seeing a huge onslaught of that right now.
Yes.
Right?
Grimes was crazy. Beeple was crazy. Like multi-million dollars of things sold in minutes, right?
That's right. So for me, those don't necessarily interest me as much, and not on a across the board basis, but just in general, some of those celebrity items don't interest me as much. One, because they're really expensive, and I think if you're going to pay for something like that, I hope you're a huge fan of whoever you're supporting, and you basically view that as a demonstration of your support. And I think the economic models, by the way, are really interesting, and they're going to get more interesting because it creates new ways for artists and fans to kind of interact with one another. It creates new ways for artists to potentially monetize their work, which I think is increasingly difficult in like a Spotify world for musical artists and for others. But some of the stuff is definitely going to be more on the extreme of like cash grabs from people who aren't really interested in developing that connection. They're just looking to kind of get paid and move on. So we're definitely going to see some of that. And so, you know, for me, it's kind of hard to sift through some of that a little bit. So I don't focus as much there. My only exception is I bought one of Mark Cuban's. He issued NFTs onto Ethereum for the first time. I want to say it was like maybe a month or two ago. And so I bought one of those on the secondary market. He created 10 copies of them. One of them, someone burned one of them as a joke, but I own one of those 9 copies of the first NFTs that Mark Cuban ever created. So,
two things. We definitely got to tell people what burning is, because a minute ago we said these can't be destroyed or damaged in a fire.
Yeah, that's right.
And then also, what are they called? What are Mark Cuban's NFTs called?
So the NFTs, yes, they can't be destroyed in a fire. However, if I own the keys, the private keys, if I have custody of an NFT, I can basically destroy it if I want to. And the way that you can technically destroy it is I can send it to an address that is no longer accessible to me. And so if I send it, and very often you'll see the way that this manifests itself on Ethereum is people will send it to the null address, which is 0x followed by a bunch of zeros. And once it's there, it's basically inaccessible.
Right. Because no one has the keys to that. If someone had the keys to it, they could get it, but it's everyone considers it to be a dead account.
That's right. Yeah. I think it's basically statistically impossible that someone is going to guess that private key for 0x00. So for all intents and purposes, that is burned. But the Mark Cuban NFT, which is called the Roll-Up 2021, it's not even that remarkable of a piece of artwork, to be honest. And so in that way, it goes against my principles of the types of stuff I try to buy, which is I try to buy things that I think look cool, created by a cool artist that I want to support or a piece of history. But I do think this one could be a piece of history because, you know, Mark Cuban has been a prolific supporter now of NFTs and of the DeFi stuff that's happening on Ethereum and elsewhere. And so I just wanted to own a piece of that. And when I look back on it in 10 years or 20 years, I'll remember, you know, how Mark was one of these early supporters, and I'll be glad to have one of those copies.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you were saying the other things that's one, you found someone that you look to, you look at artists that you really enjoy their work, you want to hold it long term. What about the more like generative, like art blocks stuff? We should probably be touching that as well.
Yeah. And before I get into the generative stuff, I'll just talk about there's certainly a huge segment in the middle, which is not the celebrity oriented stuff, but is more independent artists creating one of one works or one of 100, meaning like when they issue a work, that's how many copies of it exist. And I think that there's a lot of awesome creative talent that is happening in this space right now. It's very hard for me to say which ones are going to hold value in that space or aren't going to hold value. So I buy very selectively there, and I only buy from artists who I want to support and want to bring attention to their work. And I think increasingly you're going to see more natively digital work like that. And you talked about the Christie's auction earlier, where they're going to be auctioning off a Beeple NFT, just the NFT. They've actually done other auctions already of artwork where they had a physical artwork which came with an NFT. And I think that's an interesting like hybrid model, which we may see for a little bit longer. But over time, I think most of the interesting stuff is just going to be digital only. So that kind of takes us into this genre of generative art.
Real quick, before we get into generative art, I want to we've thrown around a lot of really cool ideas of finding cool stuff, but we haven't mentioned any websites where you can find this stuff. Are there houses or like sites that curate some of this stuff where people can go check out and view different artists?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's kind of two two sides to that. One are sites that operate more like almost like art houses, where there is a curation process in order to get listed on those sites. And so Super Rare is a good example of a site like that. Nifty Gateway is also an interesting one. And you know, the interesting thing about Nifty Gateway is they've really worked to make it easy. So even if you don't know how to use Ethereum or a crypto wallet, you can buy with a credit card or funds that you deposited in, and they'll maintain a custodied account for you. So I think that that's kind of like a model which allows people to get involved in this. There's also Rarible. And Rarible is a really popular marketplace also, but it's also a platform on which creators can issue their work. And then you can move into stuff like OpenSea, which is probably the platform I use the most, which is truly just a marketplace for these NFTs.
Yeah, it's like eBay, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And once an NFT is created, like I can take any NFT I want, I can list it on OpenSea and I can put a price on it. And if someone wants to buy it, they can, or you can even make a bid on something that someone owns. So those are some of the sites that I think are interesting.
We should mention Foundation as well too. Do you ever use Foundation at all?
I haven't used it a ton, but yeah, that's another great one. And there are several others that I'm sure that I definitely haven't mentioned, but those are some of the ones that I visit kind of the most.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll put all these in the show notes as well so people can click through to them. So on to the generative art stuff.
Yeah, and this is probably – the generative art stuff is really some of the most exciting stuff I've seen in the art space in a long time, and really on Ethereum in a long time. And so I'll kind of introduce what generative art is first. And generative art is something that's actually been around for a long time. It's a way of creating art where an artist creates an algorithm. It's now done in computers, but before, people actually created generative art by hand before there were computers. But they would follow these algorithmic rules and they would output and create an artwork based on that. And so when you create an algorithm for your generative art, what historically has happened is artists would run that algorithm, say like 1,000 times, right? Mm-hmm. And they would pick, well, these are the 5 outputs from running that I think look the best. Mm-hmm. And so they would take those 5 outputs and they would either try to sell prints of them, or they would just put them on Instagram or their website and say, hey, look at this cool thing I created. Maybe they try to get one or two exhibited in an art gallery. But that was kind of what generative art was about. Now, marry that idea with a blockchain like Ethereum, and you all of a sudden have some magic happening. So what happens with generative art when it's created on Ethereum? And we'll use Artblocks as one of the sites that I think has really done this the best and is truly artist-focused.
I agree.
Yeah, and you can find that at artblocks.io. It's run by a guy named Snowfro, who I actually talked to this morning, and he's really committed to advancing generative art and kind of bringing attention to these artists. But if you go there, you can view all of their collections. And if you look under curated projects, they do actually do a drop every week that anyone can participate in. So all of these are tokenized works on the blockchain. So here's where it becomes interesting when you bring the blockchain aspect into this. So instead of an artist curating the outputs and saying, well, here are the 5 that I thought were best and I want you to buy a print of it. Now it's a collaborative process where they put the algorithm on Ethereum, on the chain. And basically a user comes in and says, okay, I want to buy one of these. And they have no idea what they're going to buy when they go into enter that process, right? All they know is this is a limited series. Say it's like 1 of 1,000, right? And so they have the opportunity to mint one of those. And what happens is the transaction that they submit on Ethereum introduces the randomness, the random number basically that gets inputted into that artist algorithm. And then all of a sudden, that algorithm spits out an NFT, which captures that artwork. It is one of a kind. It cannot be duplicated. And it's something that is, you know, part of a broader set. I think that is super interesting. And so you can go on to Artblocks and you can browse some of these. The 2 sets that I would recommend people take a look at are Ringers by Dmitry Cherniak, which I think is one of the finest examples of
launching. I love Ringers. I love
yeah,
it. I have a few of them.
Yeah, I know you're a fan of Ringers too. But to me, when I saw that, that really revealed the value proposition of this generative art. And more recently, there's a set called Archetype by Ketil Golid. I hope I pronounced his name correct. He's a well-known generative artist who's recently released his first kind of limited series on chain. So those to me just really reveal the value proposition of digital scarcity, you have a unique work when you own one of those, but it's part of that broader set. And you can sell them or you could buy them. So I've bought a bunch of ringers on the secondary market just because I feel like this is a significant new art form, this kind of generative art. Because it's easy to say, well, I shouldn't say it's easy. Any form of generative art is certainly difficult and requires skill. But I would say it's probably easier to say, I'm going to run an algorithm 1,000 times. I'm going to pick 5 as an artist that I think are best versus turning over your entire creative process to that algorithm and not being able to control the outputs at all.
Oh my God, it is so much fun. I mean, if you've been here for a launch, and I'm sure you have, as have I, well, basically, just so people know, the one thing you do want to do is join as many kind of Discord groups as possible, because that's where a lot of the conversation is happening around this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, CryptoPunks has one, ArtBlocks has one, like they all have their own Discord groups, so you can learn a lot in there as well. I was on the Discord and I saw that they dropped one called Pathfinders just a few days ago. And I was like, oh, there's a new ArtBlocks project. It's a generative art. This is cool. I jumped on. By the time I got in there, they were doing 1,000. They were like already 920 in. So they were going super fast. And, you know, I connected my wallet. I pressed the button. And then, you know, you wait about a minute. And all of a sudden, your piece of art just appears before you. You had no say in what it was going to look like. And they all look different. And it was cool. It was like I minted that right there on the spot. And then it was sold out. And now I have a little piece of that history. And it's such a beautiful and fun, creative new way to experience. You're actually kind of taking part in the process, which is a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, these are limited series on ArtBlocks at least. So, you know, it can be difficult to get in during those initial drops, but it is a lot of fun. I actually got into my first one. I've missed the launch windows a few times, but I actually was able to mint one of the archetypes. And it was such a cool experience, just kind of not knowing what you're going to get. And it shows up in your wallet. And now it's a part of my collection. But what's also interesting is you could immediately sell it if you wanted to. But again, for me, I really consider myself more of a collector. So I just want to accumulate some of these collections that I think are really cool.
Yeah, that I'm in the same boat. Now, going back to our earlier conversation about looking at the origins of generative art on the blockchain, do we believe that Autoglyphs was the very first project that was generative art on the blockchain?
Yeah, I think most people would acknowledge that Autoglyphs was the first instance of generative art on the blockchain. And at that point, so Autoglyphs is actually created by the same creators of CryptoPunks. And basically, they are kind of like fractal lines. I almost liken it to looking like ASCII art. It's mm-hmm. like a modern, it's like a blockchain version of ASCII art. Totally. They look better than ASCII art, but you know, they were basically given away. Those are ultra scarce supply. There were only 512 Autoglyphs that were created. But now as generative art is starting to get more exposure, those are becoming hugely valuable. And I think I checked the marketplace earlier today and the floor was at like 65 Ether,
right?
Which is, and I think Ether's, the price fluctuates a lot, but at the time of this recording, that's close to $100,000.
Yeah. For just one. Right. Yeah. So it's impossible. Now I will say that I bought a couple of these cause I thought they were beautiful. There's something called Color Glyphs as well, which is essentially they took the Autoglyphs project, duplicated the code more or less, right? And just added color to them. Now, when did Color Glyphs come out? Do you know?
I don't know the exact history on that, but it was sometime after Autoglyphs. And it was being produced almost as a tribute to Autoglyphs.
Right.
And there was actually an issue with how those were distributed. The plan was to give every Autoglyph holder, from my understanding, a corresponding Color Glyph that tied to their Autoglyph that they held. They had an issue with the distribution process, but many of them are similar. Well, they are identical to Autoglyphs. They just have a colorized version to them. So like you, I saw them and I was like, wow, these are really cool. And I picked up a bunch of those as well. There is a lot of history to on-chain generative art now that has emerged even in a couple of years. So I know there are some people in the community who are working to write that up. And so hopefully that's something we can all benefit from.
Yeah, they're really beautiful. And we know we were talking about price point. Obviously $100,000 is insane for almost all people. The Color Glyphs, I'm looking right now, the floor there is around $3,500 or so for a Color Glyph. Still obviously expensive, but very, very cool stuff. Okay, so we've covered, so generative art, I am also a big fan of ArtBlocks. I think that it's a well-run organization and I like a lot of the artists that they're doing there. What else are we missing? I mean, obviously there's Hashmask, another really popular project. Are there other things that it seems like they're just coming fast and furious at this point, right? Like there's a new NFT launching every day.
There really is, and multiple new NFTs launching every day. And I will tell you that I'll look into many of them, but there is a lot of noise. So I think that's important for people to understand if you're jumping into the space. So don't put, you know, serious sums of money into sets or collections that you might not understand. There's a lot of value just to getting your bearings. One project that has launched relatively interesting that's really gotten my attention is Euler Beats, and that's spelled E-U-L-E-R after the mathematician. And so what that is that was a generative audio NFT. And it's actually one of the first, it's the first audio focused generative audio NFT. And there is a visual component to it as well. But basically when the originals were minted, there are 27 originals. They basically minted a beat onto the blockchain based on a mathematical rule. And again, your transaction hash becomes that source of randomness that created it. So those actually sound really cool. But what's really interesting about them is the economic model that's attached to them.
Yeah, we could play some in the background, by the way. That's the beautiful thing about post-editing. We'll have some playing in the background here as we're talking about this.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that. And so I actually own the originals for number 10 and 17, which I bought on the secondary market.
Wow. So you got to explain to people what that means then for you.
So basically, and I bought them on the secondary market probably when people didn't really understand what they were, so I didn't pay that much for them. But these, when you own one of those original 27, you basically own the rights to that track. So I actually own the rights to number 10 and number 17. And if someone can license that from me, and I could ask for royalties from that. What is also interesting, though, is that if someone wants to come in and buy what's called a print of one of those original LPs, they can do that. And so someone can come in and say, well, I want to buy a copy of your number 10. And so they can buy one. And then the way that the pricing works, because it's based on what's called a bonding curve that's recorded on the blockchain, without going into a lot of detail, basically each subsequent print increases in price, right? So if you want to buy one of the first prints for LP10, it's going to be fairly cheap. If you want to buy like the 100th print for LP10, it's going to be a lot more expensive.
Right.
The other interesting thing is, though, if you own one of the prints, you can burn it at any time and you can get 90% of the price of the last person who printed one, basically. So it kind of creates, it's a collectible which has instant liquidity at any time if someone wants to exit. And anytime, so as one of the original LP owners, anytime someone mints one, I actually get paid 8% of the printing cost, which is kind of cool.
In a completely automated way. You just wake up one morning and there's more ETH in your wallet.
Exactly. It's 100% automated. It's 100% trustless.
Because these are all smart contracts on the blockchain. So there's like, it's out there. It's set up and it doesn't go away. It's forever.
Exactly. There is no middleman. And I think that is incredibly powerful. So take that idea. And so Euler Beats was really the first project to combine that bonding curve mechanic with this kind of collectible. Take this and apply it really to any kind of collectible, right? So imagine a musical artist, let's say Pharrell releases a new video or a new track, right? And he wants to build up attention for that. So he could release the LP and he could choose to own it or he could even sell it, but then people can create copies of it and he gets paid every time a copy is created. And it's another way of engaging with your favorite artist. Maybe he gives his holders of his copies special benefits or rewards. So I think those are the types of like microeconomies that we're going to see evolve around NFTs that really have just not been possible around physical collectibles or non-blockchain digital collectibles.
Yeah, it is so cool. Just the number of different ways you could tweak the code to do very unique things that have just never been done before in a completely trustless automated fashion. Like, well, let's give people a real world example. So for your number LP10, which you say you own number 10, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I own number 10 and 17.
So there's been 61 prints of number 10. The current price as of this recording is 3.98790 ETH. So let's just say 4 ETH. So if I were to buy a print right now with all the gas and everything else, I think it would cost me about 4.7 ETH. Mm-hmm. The next print would jump up. So the next print would go from 3.98 to 4.26. So it would jump up and then it just continues from there and it gets crazy expensive. I think the most expensive one would probably be LP1 right now, right?
Yeah, LP1's the most expensive because it's kind of become a selling point for people who are jumping into this. But I think, you know, as the price goes up, and so someone actually pointed it out to me and says, well, isn't this just kind of like some kind of Ponzi game where people are just coming in and buying them and then you burn them and you get some of the reward? And my response to that was kind of like, well, all collectibles are kind of like that if you really extend the analogy far enough, because a collectible is only worth what someone else is willing to pay you for it, right? And I think that that's important for any buyer of an NFT to understand. If you buy an NFT and you can't sell it, then it's not worth anything, right? It's worth whatever someone else will pay you for. The unique thing about Euler Beats is anyone can sell it or burn it, is what they call it. Anyone can burn it at any time on the blockchain. And so there is always liquidity. So what it does is it creates a highly efficient price discovery mechanism that really, you know, you don't have with other collectibles necessarily, because you're waiting for someone else to basically buy or sell it. With Euler Beats, anyone can sell or burn at any time.
Yeah. Well, what's crazy is if you were one of the first people on this site and you heard of this project and you bought something, let's just say you bought a print of LP1 for one ETH, you can now burn that original one that you paid one for and get 90% of, you know, 22.8, which is what the current price is, right? So you would actually have a fantastic return on your investment there, even though that's not the point, but it's interesting.
It is. And it's kind of like what you talked about before. So I only advise people to buy this stuff if they want to collect it. So I actually bought prints of all 27 because I thought this was really cool. And I was like, I want to own a piece of these. And I know several other people who did the same thing because we just felt like this was something significant. And we don't plan to burn or to sell them. But yeah, I bought a copy of number one, I think, for like one ether or less. And so if I wanted to, I could burn it right now and I could get 22 Ether. But I'm not going to do that because I think it's just something that I think is cool and I want to hang on to. And it goes back to kind of what you talked about with your CryptoPunk, right? You're not going to sell your zombie punk anytime soon, if ever.
Right.
You want to hang on to it. And so the more people like you that there are in a collectibles market and like me, that establishes a higher and higher price floor. Because at some point, if there's enough people like us who don't want to sell, the price has to go up.
Yeah, it's crazy. What are your thoughts on Unisocks?
So Unisocks are a really interesting one. And for your listeners who don't know, there is an exchange, a decentralized exchange on Ethereum known as Uniswap. And it was actually the first what we call an automated market maker exchange on Ethereum. And it is currently the most popular decentralized exchange on the platform, doing billions and billions of dollars worth of volume. And so at one point they released a collectible, which is actually it's a token called Socks. So you can actually go into a token tracking app and type in Socks and Socks will pop up, believe it or not. And that is actually a fungible token, believe it or not. So if you remember what I talked about, the interchangeable versus the non-interchangeable token. And I think there were like 500 of them created. What Uniswap did that was interesting was they deposited those into their exchange. And on the other side of that, they deposited some ether. And because of how automated market makers work, without getting into the details, that basically put a price on Socks. And I think they were actually quite inexpensive at first, right? They were pretty cheap. You could buy it for like a few bucks, certainly less than $100. But as more people started to buy them, it's a similar kind of bonding curve mechanic to what I discussed with Euler Beats. The price started to go up because there was less supply on the exchange.
Well, we should tell people what you can actually do with that token, because there actually is a utility for the Socks token.
That's right. You can actually redeem, and again, this is basically burning one of those SOC tokens, and you can actually get a NFT which comes out of that. And that part is automated on the blockchain. It spits out an NFT which goes into your wallet that says you own one pair of socks. But Uniswap will also mail you a pair of socks to anywhere in the world. And there's actually a pair of these socks. So you're probably wondering now, if you're listening, how much are these things worth now? Well, I told you they launched at less than $100. Right now, a socks token is worth $105,000.
That's just insanity.
Yeah, and that's actually dropped a little bit from where it was a few days ago. I think it peaked out at close to like 160,000. So these are hyper volatile, obviously.
Yeah, and when people are listening to this, at first glance, and I'm in your camp, I know so many people are like, this is ridiculous. Like, you're buying a Sox token that you can for $100,000 that'll send you a pair of socks. It sounds like silly, and it is. But here's the one thing that's really interesting. It's the mechanics behind what is going on here that are applicable to more things than just socks. Because what you're saying is you can launch a product, get price discovery, and figure out what that product is worth, and without even having to build the product until it is redeemed. So imagine a world like, I mean, we've all seen this, like, you're in LA or New York or somewhere else where they have Supreme stores, and there's a drop that's happening. There's a line of kids that, you know, is blocks long, and they're all trying to wait in line to get something limited edition. Or you have a pair of Yeezys that are dropping, and everyone wants to buy this particular sneaker. So they have to purchase a sneaker. They bring the sneaker home. They take photographs of it. They put it back online. They try and flip it and sell it. In this case, forget socks. Let's just say this is the next version of the Yeezy sneaker. You could have this on here. People could buy the Yeezy token. They never have to take ownership of it. They can say, I'm willing to spend $350 for the Yeezy token. The price discovery happens. Let's just say it nets out at, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. You can then just instantly transfer the digital token to someone else that says, okay, I will sit on this token. I don't ever have to hold the shoes. But at any time, whoever buys this token from me, maybe it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, they can click redeem, burn the token, get an NFT collectible, and also get a physical pair of the shoes shipped to them. It's just a new way of thinking of things that I think there is something here that is lasting, that will be built, that is less silly than a pair of socks.
Absolutely. And I think the notability of socks is this was the first token that ever did that. And so I think that there is going to be value in some of these firsts. And so if you look at my collection, which anyone can go on to OpenSea and just type in DC Investor, I have a public wallet with most of my holdings. I buy a lot of these things that did first. And I bought one Sox token just because it was the first one that did it. And I paid a lot less than $105,000 for it. But what I will tell you is, if I wanted to sell it literally right now while we're on this chat, I could actually sell it into that exchange, that automated market maker, and I could get $105,000 for it. And there are not many collectibles, real world collectibles, where you can have that kind of liquidity. So that's why I go back to, you know, what I talked about earlier. These digital collectibles have this unique utility to them, and that actually gives them greater price as a result of that utility, because they have more use economically, and they will have more use economically than a lot of physical real world collectibles.
Yeah, it's the Wild West, and it's fun in all the right ways. You know, it reminds me of the early crypto days. Just like, you know, people are just pushing the envelope in new and unique ways, and some of it'll work, and some of it'll lead to even greater things than the original project. And yeah. So what else is out there that you find interesting? Anything worth noting?
I think we covered a lot of the stuff that I'm most interested in. There are a lot of other projects that I'm looking at, like Ether Cards is another one that's launching, where they're actually launching with a collectible, but they're creating a platform for NFTs, and those cards have functionality in them. So I think one space that people should keep an eye out for, especially for those who are familiar with the Ethereum blockchain, is more of these economic collectibles. I think Euler Beats has kind of unlocked something that's going to be very compelling, where people and artists are going to want to be able to monetize things over a sustainable basis. Another point that I didn't talk about earlier was, for a lot of these NFTs, for marketplaces that support it, whenever one of them is sold, a royalty goes back to the artist. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that a lot of collectors find important. That's something that I find important. So if I buy someone's Art Blocks piece, if I buy one of the Ringer series, a little portion of my funds that I use to pay for that goes back to Dmitry Cherniak, the artist. And I think that creates kind of this sustainability and this much better loop. And yeah, they're not getting all of the profit that perhaps the flipper made off of it. But if they get that across all of the pieces in their set, it allows them to continue to earn some income and continue their work. And I think that's something that's really important.
Absolutely. That's one of the, such a beautiful piece of this, is just making sure that some of these things go for tens of thousands or millions of dollars later, the artist gets a little cut is awesome. And it's exciting. Also, the other thing we didn't mention is some more of the programmable NFTs that are, well, I guess there's other chains that are out there outside mm-hmm. of Ethereum where they're talking about, okay, well, what happens if you make art into a encrypted contract where you can't see the outcome of what's going to happen? So, you know, the art can morph or change over time. So if it's a certain time of day or day of the year, the picture that you have on your wall, the digital art that you have on your wall changes into something else. Like there's a lot of creativity that could be packed in here long-term. That's pretty exciting.
Absolutely. And I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation, which I'm looking forward to. I think the other piece that I'll highlight again, but we didn't talk about a lot today, is this concept of in-game items. I think that's going to become a huge, huge series of economies within each of these games. And we already see it on Ethereum now with a couple of games like Axie Infinity and Gods Unchained. And you can actually buy tokens for those projects and use them within the game. The limitation right now of Ethereum's kind of base layer is it's expensive to use because there's limited capacity and there's very high demand. And so we're seeing new technologies emerge now, which will allow for scaling at subsequent layers on Ethereum. And I think as that's unlocked there and also on other blockchains, you're just going to see a huge explosion. So that's something we can probably have another conversation about in yes. a year and be blown away by how much has happened.
Yeah, agreed. One thing to touch on real quick before we have to wrap up, people would be upset if we didn't go a little deeper on NBA Top Shots sure. because it is, you know, one of the biggest projects out there. I am not a collector, and I'll say because I just don't know. Individual moments to me, unless they're really meaningful, meaning like, don't get me wrong, every year in the NBA, there are very historic things that happen, right? Like some new record that is broken or some amazing play that has just never been done before. Those to me feel very collectible. Rookie cards in that world feel very collectible to me. But I have to imagine, you know, when I see a Steph Curry three-pointer going for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then I wonder, okay, let's extrapolate that out to another 10 years of his career or 5 years of his career. If this is one of hundreds or thousands of three-pointers that he shot that is a collectible, doesn't the value then go down? And I get that it's earlier, meaning like it was one of the first ones on the chain, but I don't know. I'm a little skeptical there. What are your thoughts on Top Shot?
Well, I think a lot of collectibles like that, it really boils down to what's the collector base look like and how much supply is there. And that's true of art as well, by the way. I'll just say for artists who create too much work and they're very prolific and their work is undifferentiated, I tend to shy away from those artists other than buying a piece every now and then to kind of support them. But you can't expect value to be maintained if there's just a glut of their work. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to see that in collectibles market. So I think Top Shots has done a lot of interesting things by simplifying the fiat money on ramp and that sort of thing. But it does, to me, remain to be seen how many collectibles can hold these ultra high price tags when you're continually kind of releasing new series. And the only way it really does that is if the collector base continues to grow and if there or if current collectors are willing to spend more money. So I don't advise really that people put huge sums of money into stuff like that. If you want to buy a few to hold and just kind of speculate on or just collect them. Hey, I've got a bunch of basketball cards under my mattress at my mom's house that they're probably worth nothing. There are probably a few that are worth something. And so the difference here with these Top Shots is at least you know how many are created. And so, yeah, it's something that I also don't participate in and don't collect for those reasons.
Yeah, I don't think there's any downside to buying some of the packs as they're released, because they release them like the old school format where it's almost like you're buying a pack of cards like you used to back in the day. Those are obviously very inexpensive and anyone can do that. So that's kind of a fun way to play this. Yeah, the question I have is when you see, you know, ones that are going for several hundred thousand dollars or $100,000 plus, it's like, how deep is the market there? Like how many people have that much money to spend on one of these and are willing to do so over time when there's more and more of them that exist? And then, well, I guess they could introduce fractional ownership, right? Where they could say, okay, you mm-hmm. can put this up and now 100 people can all own a piece of it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm going to kind of sit on the sidelines on this one and see how it plays out. But it is a fun project. And I do love that it is so mainstream. I guarantee you there's a certain percentage of people that are doing it that have no idea that it's even on a blockchain or what blockchain it's on, you know, because they have made it super easy to just put in a credit card and purchase something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I've been critical of parts of their model because there are delays and withdrawals, and because there are parts of it that are not as decentralized as I would like them to be. But there's no doubt that they've really shown what the value proposition of these digital collectibles are to retail users across the world. So I think that there's a lot to be learned from what they've done. And I really do think it's kind of just the beginning of this digital collectible boom and NFTs that we're about to see.
Yeah. Well, Aftab, thank you so much, aka DC Investor. Where can people find you if they want to keep up? Because I would say Twitter is number one, right? Because you have so much good advice on there. I highly recommend people follow you there.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Kevin. And yeah, on Twitter, you can find me at I am DC Investor. I'm also on Reddit as DC Investor. So those are the two best places to find me. And I'm all around the chat rooms for all of these exciting projects.
Are there any good subreddits for this? Because I was on one NFT one and it looked pretty dead. Is any of them taken off?
You know, unfortunately not. A lot of the activity, and there's pros and cons to this, but a lot of it has shifted to Discord and to Twitter. And it makes it hard for newer people to come in to find like authoritative pieces of information. So there is a lot to sift through for new entrants. And yeah, I don't really have better advice than to just get onto Twitter and start to follow some of the right folks. I actually have one of my lists is I have a list of NFT follows that you guys might want to give a look to, and joining some of the high quality discords like Artblocks and CryptoPunks will also get you into the game a little bit.
100%. Awesome. Well, we'll put links and all kinds of goodness in the show notes. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
All right. That is it. First episode is done. Thank you for listening. Do me a favor. If you enjoyed this, send it to some friends. The number one thing, obviously, when you're starting any new podcast, any new show, we want to get the word out there. I have a fantastic lineup of guests covering all different financial topics. Send this episode to friends. You can also check out the website. I'm going to have the complete and full show notes for every single episode. Really going to do this right. You can find it. It's a hilarious website, by the way. It's pretty bad, but on purpose. You can find it at mofi.net. Thanks so much. Take care.